The third speaker tonight will be William F. Ward from the Social Support Fund.
The future of socialism in America and the world cannot be charted apart from the future of the capitalist system. When tired radicals express skepticism about the possibilities of socialism in our time, they express in that indirect way an unspoken and unspent confidence in the endurance of capitalism. What are the real prospects of these contending social systems? I believe the best years of capitalism are behind it. Its worst years lie ahead. Look first of all at what has happened to world capitalism since 1914. Up to that turning point, capitalism had been growing for 400 years until it had conquered the whole planet. To most people, it seemed as though this expansion would go unchallenged for another four centuries. Then came the Russian Revolution of 1917, the first big breach in the structure of international holders of the old order. Instead of capitalism reconquering the Soviet Union, as it would have done had Hitler been victorious, capitalist rule was further eliminated, first in Eastern Europe, then in China, Viet Minh, North Korea. Today, one-third of the people on the Earth's surface are no longer directly exploited by profiteers. That's not all. The awakening of the colored races has torn one country after another in Asia, the Middle East, and Africa from the talons of the old imperialist vultures. So, as the result of two suicidal wars and their revolutionary effects, world capitalism now not only misses a gold tooth or two, it has an arm and leg amputated and limps from one crisis to the next. Now, it's hard to deny that on the world arena, world capitalism has been badly battered over the past 40 years. But then it's objective. American capitalism stands out as a radiant exception, doesn't it? Hasn't the sun of prosperity been shining here since 1940? Isn't business bigger and better than ever? It's certainly bigger. Isn't the standard of living higher? Isn't the United States the mightiest power on the globe? Yes, these facts have to be admitted. They also have to be interpreted and viewed in their proper proportion and historical perspective from a Marxist and working class standpoint. While American capitalism has been surging forward, the world system to which it belongs has been sinking. And this raises two great questions. Which counts for more in the scale of historical development? The overturns of capitalism in Eastern Europe and Eastern Asia, plus the growing independence of the colonial peoples, or the flourishing of capitalism on one continent and in one country? Has international capitalism been weakened more than its American sector been strengthened? The answer, I believe, favors the former. What we're witnessing is a gigantic reversal in the trends of world history. The movement for the advancement of capitalism, which dominated world history from the 16th to the 20th centuries, has been supplanted increasingly by the anti-capitalist movement of the socialist working class and the anti-colonial movement of its allies. Such is the central line of world social development in our time. Now comes the second question. Will the American capitalists be able to raise the declining sectors of capitalism and the backward countries up to their own level? Or will these sooner or later drag the high and mighty monopolists down toward their level? This is the fundamental problem that the men of Washington and Wall Street are now grappling with. Their loans, plans, propaganda, and doctrines are designed to shore up the sagging foundations of capitalism, to bribe, bludgeon, or beat back the anti-capitalist and anti-imperialist mass movements. Why? In order to prevent them from rising up in time within this country itself. I won't deny they've had temporary successes as well as setbacks in these efforts. But in the long run, their Cold War is going to be a losing proposition for them. The central point to grasp is this. Capitalism cannot thrive or even survive in a single country indefinitely, any more than socialism can be built in a single country. Both are world systems. Their forces are in continuous conflict with each other, despite episodic armistices and agreements. Either the forces of socialism will dislodge the power of big business in this, its central stronghold, or this terrible power will attempt to annihilate the forces of socialism, whatever the cost. At this point, I hear a voice object. Do you call what exists in the Soviet Union and under Moscow's domination socialist? No, it's not socialism. Any more than an ugly caterpillar, which may become a butterfly, is that beautiful butterfly itself. It's a transitional society which has cut loose from capitalism but is far, far from socialism. In most of its features, the Soviet Union as a degenerated worker state stands much closer to the old order out of which it has emerged than to the new order its leaders claim to have realized. But fundamentally, it represents an advance in its economy over anything capitalism has to offer. I stated at the outset that the best years of capitalism are behind it and the worst are ahead. Let me round out this statement. The worst years for socialism are behind it, while the best ones loom ahead. Today, socialism is under a cloud, as you've already heard, and carries a heavy burden because of the abominations of Stalin. How did these come about, briefly? The first contingents of the anti-capitalist forces broke through the ring of capitalist ownership, not at its strongest, but at its weakest points, not at its center in Europe and America, but at its extremities, not in the most qualified countries, but in the most backward. This produced the following paradoxical situation. Capitalist rule has hung on in those countries best prepared for socialism, while capitalist relations have been abolished in those parts of Europe and Asia which were the most economically underdeveloped and least suitable for the building of socialism. This very point is emphasized in the introduction to Professor Baran's new book, which I happened to read last night. These facts, arising from the uneven development of the world socialist revolution, have created enormous difficulties for the anti-capitalist countries. They have also given birth to terrible deformities in their political structure and their inner life, and to the most unprincipled deviations from socialist conduct. The imperialist encirclement of the Soviet Union between the two world wars, piled on top of its inherited low productivity and culture, made possible the usurpation of power by the Stalinist bureaucracy with the evils Khrushchev unveiled. But that's not the whole of the story. It's only a very dark and dreadful chapter in it. Very dark and dreadful indeed. After the Second World War, the two main conditions for the birth and growth of Stalinism, the backwardness of Soviet society and its imperialist encirclement, became modified. Thanks to its nationalized industry and planned economy, however distorted, The Soviet Union became the world's second industrial power, while uprooting of capitalist relations in Eastern Europe and Asia relaxed its isolation. And now we see another paradoxical result, quite unexpected by the Stalinist rulers and their parties. These very successes have emboldened the Soviet masses to make demands upon their bureaucratic overlords and win concessions from them. These, in turn, have stimulated the vassalized peoples of Eastern Europe to rise up and fight for their national dignity and independence and for democratized workers' regimes. The events since Stalin's death, culminating in the Polish and Hungarian uprisings, give ample warrant for believing that the hardest years for the socialist movement in the East are behind and better years are in the offing. The political upheavals fermenting there, irrepressible, will penetrate into the center of bureaucratic Stalinism and eventually replace its despotism with genuinely democratic working class regimes. These will once again become the source of encouragement rather than depression and demoralization to socialists in the West. These developments abroad, which I've briefly reviewed, transmitted through the crisis of the Communist Party, have changed the atmosphere among socialist-minded elements in the country. This symposium, unthinkable a year ago, gives local evidence of that. And it's an advance. I say so, although a calamity chorus sees nothing in the new situation but the breakup and demoralization of the old formation. But this loosening from old positions and perspectives is the necessary precondition for the working out of new and better ones. This shakeup of the socialist forces is taking place in a prolonged period of general passivity of American labor. This has the disadvantage that the debate over the problems of American socialism and the future of labor are confined to a restricted circle. That's the present reality. We're not talking now to tens of thousands of people in this hall. We're talking to people primarily interested in the problems of socialism. But that gives us time to clarify many questions before American capitalism is thrown off balance again and by explosive events originating here or abroad, and before the workers of this country enter a new stage of militancy and radicalism. My concluding remarks will deal with only one of our pressing problems, the question of unity among the socialist forces, which we have all spoken about. We all agree that in general it's necessary, but how much of it is now possible? I don't see that conditions have ripened at the present stage for any broad organizational mergers. That may be a desirable goal, but it's a somewhat distant prospect. The principal reason is that the requisite unity of thought on the main issues of national and international politics, which must provide the necessary basis for a realistic and solid unification, has not yet been achieved. Encouraging progress has been made over the past year through forum groupings and symposiums in breaking down barriers that separated and opposed us in the past, so that we can get to know what each other stands for, fights for, hopes for. But this process is only at its beginning. Two heartening recent developments indicate that it can be carried a step further. One was the United May Day meeting in New York, the first in several decades, which drew an overflow crowd and raised the spirit of solidarity among the participants. Equally important is the establishment of the American Forum for Socialist Education. Now, I want to propose unity of action here and now, first on the Sobel case, and second on the padlocking of the California Labor School and its appeal to the courts. And such unity is realistic and imperative while we continue frank, free, and fraternal discussion of our differing views.